Accession number 10165, reel number 22.
Martin McLean, reel 22. You just joined the rest of your unit again, and if you could take up the story from there.
We joined the unit, the scattered remnants of the regiment, because they'd been involved in a terrific fight in St. Venant, and they'd been overrun by tanks and by an awful lot of German army, who were the Jugend youth, Hitler youth. And they had such a force of tanks with them that the battalion couldn't contain them at St. Venant. And it was a terrific carnage took place of men being killed and this, that and the other. And lots of reports about one sergeant major who refused to take his men in action. And he was supposedly shot by somebody, which I won't mention, but he was taken into a cellar and supposed to be shot for cowardice. That is a rumour. I know more about it, but I'm not going to talk about it. All these reports were coming back at where we were huddled. Now, the remnants of Battalion HQ and a few fighting men left of the battalion. It was a shock. A tremendous shock to the whole system to realise that all the lads that you knew over the so many, many years and played with the rugby at football and done all the sports and mucked in together, as we term it in the army, now gone. The reports have come back of the pals that were killed and so on badly wounded and others they don't know what happened to. But the battalion was completely overrun and the command officer had been taken prisoner. And the Germans were pressing on, and that is why the balance of the div were withdrawn and shoved into this place for to sort of resemble. I told you about Lieutenant Rudd. He had joined us somehow. He had also got away from this devastated D Company on the Battle of Rougette, just close to St. Venant. As a matter of fact, having read through history now, that is the place where the Germans had bridged the river, Bridge Le Bassy Canal, and every one of the British army was in complete ignorance of it. And here was this whole of the German army might bridged across the position that D Company was in at Rocher, and that is where the whole main of the attack came in from St. Venant on more or less a flank. Lieutenant Rudd had been with us there, I mentioned this, and he had now joined us with the remnants of the men. We were given some food of some description, a stew, which was really sustaining because we're hungry. We hadn't had anything for a long time. Time and space and feeding and systematic things with the body are just gone. You just follow on, do what you've got to do. If food comes along, you accept it. If it's not there, you just tighten your belt a bit and carry on until you do receive food. We received food this time. And next morning, early on, I was told that we were going to move off again. They assembled the fighting remnants, I'm talking about the rifle companies, of the battalion, about 60 strong of us. I'd say about 57, but I'd say, again, the average talk was 60. Lieutenant Rudd in charge, with Sergeant Major Metcalf, who was the Sergeant Major who spoke about at Rocher, crossing the Lice Canal and all that. We also had a Sergeant Major Burkitts, who was Company Sergeant Major of Headquarter Company, and we also had another Sergeant Major, Hurrigan, who was a PSM, this one, same rank as myself, who was the Pioneer Sergeant Major, Pioneer Platoon Sergeant Major.
That's 60, about 60 of the company left.
About 60 of the battalion, the whole battalion of maybe 800 or 900 strong. There was some transport people, the quartermaster staff, the adjutant and others. They obviously were going to travel wherever they had to by the transport and the road. I don't know. We just received an order to move, and we moved. Again, I stress here, I, as a sergeant major, received no instruction whatever. Just, right, we're on the move, collect your men, fall in, we're off. That's it. So off we set. We marched along this road, and to goodness knows where. Now, I wish to stop there, because I wish to backtrack somewhat, because I have missed an awful lot of detail about the effects of war, what I saw, and apart from our own individual battle, what was taking place around us, and just what we saw and felt. It was after we came out from the River Dyle, we formed up, as I've told you, by rearguard action, a little bit action here and a little bit action there. And it was decided to march the whole of the 2nd Div out of the area. And we marched out. Now, I could be a bit befuddled in here in times and dates because so many years afterwards, you tend to forget. And we marched off, the whole division, and we crossed through Brussels in the middle of the night. And it was this is where the soldiers were really astounded at the force of what explosions could do. In Brussels, they had tram cars, and shells had hit the tram lines and bent them away our heads about 20 feet in the air. And there they were just built as blown up as if and bent as if they were just pieces of wire. The tram cars were on the side, and craters of shell holes all over the place. We were stunned to see this. We heard bombs, we'd seen shells, but these couldn't have been shells. They must have been dive bombing, but they have such a hard effect on the area, you know, the explosive effect. We were stunned at all this, but we had been dive bombed ourselves before, but, you know, as you scarp it out of it or get out of it, you don't go back to look to see what the dive bombers had done until much later on near Dunkirk. We marched on through the night, and we crossed the Belgian border again through across the frontier of Belgium-France. And I've mentioned this, we passed through our own unit lines at Noumien area, where we had done all the preparations and digging for defence. Now, the general impression among us was, now, I'm not saying I was a brave man, but I was prepared to fight again. I was a professional soldier. My job was to fight. And I anticipated that we're going to be deployed into our defensive positions where we had prepared prior to all this. But we marched through them and we were astounded. And on the side of the road, practically untouched, were some huge American excavators and bulldozers, the likes of which we had never seen before, which we had been using for digging the anti-tank ditches. And they just seemed to be left there for the Germans to take. I think these things should have either been blown up or burnt or destroyed. But this was in the panic and the move of going back. I shouldn't say panic, but the orderly withdrawal. We marched from Mouchin to Lille. And somewhere along the line, we halted. It must have been either before we reached Brussels or after it. We reached the Albert Canal. The Albert Canal, and we landed at a place called Tournai. And we were going to make a defensive stand here, the whole of the 2nd Division. Yes, that is before the St. Vincent affair. I'm thinking as I'm talking. So it was before the St. Vincent affair, when we had the whole battalion. And we were formed up to do some fighting near the Albert Canal at Tournai. And were given positions to dig in and given some cottages which to use for our shelter and try to obtain food. Well, all around where we were, there was herds of beautiful cows that had been killed or died through being unmilked and things like that. They're black and white hides, great big, beautiful beasts. Their legs stuck up and out from direct because they're now bloating, and the smell was a bit horrific. Here we were wanting meat or some things of this, and all these cattle, wherever we went from now on, we saw killed and left absolutely as if the farmers had gone away and left them. Those that were alive were crying for the want somebody to milk them because their udders were completely full of milk. We took up these positions at Tournai and were told to open our mouths and to put our fingers in our ears when they heard when they fired a rocket or something of that nature. They were going to blow up the Albert Canal, and it put so much aminol into blowing it up that would cause such a terrific crack. So this is what we done, saw the signal, and it blew it up. And it went up with such a terrific bang. We'd never heard the likes of it before. We'd seen the dive bombers, we'd seen the explosions of shells and things, we'd seen demonstrations pre-war. But this was such a colossal explosion. And looking towards the Albert Canal, you could see the pieces of metal flying into the air. Sadly, that it was rumoured, and it is more than just rumour. A lot of the British troops who are struggling behind were left stranded on the other side. But then it was a matter of decision by the senior officers concerned, they must have had reports that the Germans were closing in with their patrols, their armoured patrols, and getting near the bridge, so they blew it up. All them young people, young soldiers, etc., all different regiments now, would be stranded and taken prisoner, because unless they tried to get across the canal, as I did, at the Lys Canal. We saw the effect of shelling by the German artillery. Where we were, it was a bit back from the canal. I think we were the support battalion. A support battalion means that in the event of a breakthrough by the Germans or the enemy, you go in with a bayonet and sort them out and regain the positions. That was our role in this sort of fighting. The other units up front had been digging in, as we had, because no matter where you are, support or what have you, you dig in into defensive positions, dig trenches, that's all it amounts to, and prepare to put your men under cover for to do some shooting and fighting. They start shelling the big houses just opposite from us, and the effect of the shells on these houses, it just dismantled big, tall buildings, and the stone and the debris and the dust and everything was flying around. Now, in all of this, which I haven't taken much time to talk about, was the refugees. The poor, pathetic people that were walking along the roads, you had to see them to believe them, with old horse and carts, farm carts, of big ones, little ones, small ones, all loaded up with their family possessions. All the people looking frightened and desperate, walking along the roads, not knowing what was happening, not knowing what to do. They had dog carts laden up with stuff. They had bicycles laden up with stuff. The men were carrying big loads on their backs. The children were plodding alongside the road. And to see them when they heard the shelling and things like this, they were horrified, of course. They were terrified, no mind horrified, in case they would be hit. Later on, I'll be talking about when so many of them were hit. They were old people there who were collapsing, exhausted. And the people who were trying to recover them, you could see them huddled around the person, and they'd eventually lift her, on her or him onto a cart, and they'd move off on the road. I think that these Belgians and the French would have been well advised to stay where they were, put in their own houses. Because as we found in all these Belgian and French houses, which we were using now, without any fear, we're just going in, using them for all of them had a cellar in. We used the cellars for, like, our platoon headquarters or for our MI room and things of that nature. Why these poor people hadn't been advised to stay there instead of taking the high roads, I'll never know, nor will anyone else. It was just maybe their previous knowledge of the First World War and the effects of it that they decided to get out. I cannot speak to deeply on this. It was so appalling to us men to see these people struggling along, and we couldn't help them because we were marching as well. Well, after the bridge had blown, orders came to this to us. The second division was going to march off, and that's where we started marching off from them. The whole division. It was more or less a forced march. We'd have a halt now and again, but we walked miles upon miles with no sort of rest for food, no rest for any lengthy period, just maybe the ordinary halt to release your equipment, let the circulation flow back in your feet. By that I mean, a soldier was taught to lie on his back and raise his feet if he felt a bit heavy in the legs, so as to allow the blood to flow back into the rest of his body. It was a custom. You'd find the men lying in ditches with their feet up height, as if they were relaxing. Well, it was also part of the training we received. Then we went, as I mentioned, we went through Mouchin and we went through Lille. Passing through Lille, we then dispersed, we halted. And now, you've got to understand this, we weren't mechanised. We had gone through a terrific lot of fighting and the Holocaust of war, that's a new word which we learned from the aftermath of the war. We went through all this Holocaust, we were horrified and stupefied at what was happening, and the lack of sleep and lack of food was telling upon us. I, for instance, was never given any orders what to do with a move here, a move there, which I've explained before. We were told to get ready for to go into defensive positions. And so we moved off with D Company, which I've already explained fully about. But there you have it, my little stories and impressions of the horror of war, the effect of shelling, the effect of the refugees on the road who are cluttering the road, and the effect of the war on us as soldiers who are prepared to fight, but now completely neglected by the people who supplied food and rations and things. If the battalion had food, I'm quite sure they would have fed us. Now, I'd like to go back to where we set off on a march with Lieutenant Rudd in charge, and as I said, I never knew where. We are marching through this beautiful sunshine area. It was a beautiful, beautiful day, marching through the streets, and now we had adopted automatically single files on each side of the road, because the transport was always wanting past. If you were in threes, then the transport couldn't get past. Now we split up, and this is a thing that the army adopted from there on, incidentally. That was a section on, in the front on one side of the road, another section on the other, and another section of men on the opposite side. So there was a gap where the traffic could go around. It was done this automatic without any advising by anyone. It was just something that the troops done. We kept marching on until a terrific thunderstorm hit us. And everybody by then didn't have any waterproof clothing. That was the gas cape. I had one, incidentally. I never dumped any of my kits. I'd picked up another one after the St. Venant business where I swam the canal. I'd picked up another gas cape and I wore it because I realised the advantage of it. It came torrential rain, so the order was given every man, get shelter. And all around us, there was some hen crease, which you would call hen huts or hen houses. We in the north call them the crease. And everybody darted into these sheltered things. And some fell asleep because exhausted and what they'd gone through. It was a chance of relaxation, fell asleep. I was alert all the time and I just kept talking to some of the lads I was with. And then when the sunshine came out again and the rain had dissipated, I went out on the road and I took my few men with us. I said, well, what's happened? There was two or three more men coming out of the huts. So I sent the lads around looking in the other huts for other men. We found some, but the officer, Lieutenant Rudd, the Sergeant Major's concern mentioned before, had one. There's no sign of them. So I marched up the top of this hill, and at the top of this hill there was a few houses, and in it was a house that was in the preparation of being rebuilt. There was no frontage to it, a huge cement building, which we went in. The French army had apparently used it for a billet because there was straw on the ground. So I told the men to lay in there and have a rest until I found out what was happening. And they just, well, they lay down and fell asleep. That was it. And I was standing at the door waiting for others coming. A few more stragglers came up the road. And I herded them into this place. And then I went back to them and I tell me, I said, does anyone know where the officer and the sergeant majors went? Then two or three men, yes, they got on a lorry and left us. And I was astounded at this because if they had to leave us for any specific purpose, you'd think they would have informed me as to where they were going and what was happening. I was left completely in the dark. So I had these men in this hut, and outside of the place where I was, it was like looking back where we had come from, a huge landscape target. A landscape target is a printed piece of paper or scenery placed upon cardboard to indicate a wooded area or an area of land with roads, with hills, with trees, with everything for giving fire orders on the range. I'm not going to try and explain, but let's put it this way. Looking to the right, there's a huge panorama of countryside with its roads, its trees, its green grass and the hedgerows. And wherever you looked, you could see the glint of lorries, the windscreens, the sun was catching the windscreens, and they were glinting as they came down. You could see marching troops, you could see horses and carts, you could see them all seemingly coming in our direction. And passing me at the time was a unit of infantry. You don't have to ask why. You could tell they were infantry. They were infantry. You could tell by the looks in their eyes and the shattered feeling of seeing so many of the men killed and what they'd gone through themselves, that they were in a sort of walking in a stupefaction manner. There was a major passing with quite a large company of men. They mustn't have been involved with much fighting. I don't know. There may have been a TA battalion, reserve battalion. So I walked along with the major. I said, "Sir, what is happening?" He said, "Don't you know?" I said, "No, sir." I said, "I've got a platoon of men here, and I want to know what we've got to do." He says, "Well, the order is everybody make for the port of Dunkirk. They're trying to evacuate the British Army." Well, this was the first time I'd heard this, and I was stupefied. I thanked the major or even saluted him for his information. I was just stupefied to think that the British Army, that we love so much, that I love so much, incidentally, were beaten in battle and were going to evacuate us. I went back and woke the men up and told them what had happened. They, like me, were astounded. We thought we were going to be herded back and put into some other position where we'd do some fighting. Well, I harnessed the men up, that was, put their equipment on, and said, "Let's get on the road." And as we went out of the shed again, there was a huge convoy of brand new Bedford lorries past us. They had no one in the back, so I stopped one of the lorries. I said, "What's happening? Where are you going?" They said, "We were sent to pick up some units of the army, but they can't get at them now because of the fact that the roads have been cut by the Germans, so we've been told to make back for Dunkirk." I stopped the trucks and put our men on, and all of the stragglers that was passing. You know, people without units. I said, "Get on here, get on here." Well, I was to go in the front with our driver, the last vehicle, so that I could be with my men. And past me at the time was an officer who was completely out. Well, if you've been a cyclist, you know what the knock is. That means where your whole body becomes immune to pain and you're useless. You're slavering from the mouth, you're snotting from the nose, and you're staggering all over the shop. You're out in all sense of the word, but you've just got a bare sense to keep going and stagger along. Well, that's what we used to call a knock. Well, this officer was in exactly that state. So I stopped him. I said, "Sir," I said, "you're in no state to work any further." And he got on talking. He was voluble in his talk because he's upset at all he's seen. It turned out he's a Roman Catholic priest. I don't know what regiment. I did know at the time, but I forget. So I said, "Look, sir, you get in the front with the driver, and I'll get in the back." So I put him in the front, and I shout the driver to wait for us. While I got in the back, the driver pulled away and left me. So I continued walking on. That was it. I was fit enough to walk. A short while further on, I caught up with some of the lads. There was these lorries that couldn't proceed any further, and they realised that I'd been left behind. They were waiting for me, mainly men in my battalion. And we saw all these lorries stop. We didn't know the reason why. We hadn't a clue what was in front of us. We were now leaving the battle area. We're now coming at the first signs of Dunkirk. All these brand new lorries where somebody had been trying to destroy them. Others just left as they were brand new. It was a damn shame to think that when we were learning to drive and things, if we scraped the paint off the side, we're up before the company commander and given a fine or punishment of some description for damaging or bending a mudguard or simple little things. And here was all these lorries just piled nose to nose. We didn't know what it was for, but later we were shocked to think they were all just left there for the Germans. We all fell in now in single file, marching down the road, and we're coming down off this tall hill that I'd been standing on. I must have looked a terrific sight, because, with all the other soldiers, dirty, unkempt, and really speaking, as a regular soldier, we sort of felt it. We always thought we should have set an example to remain there, but after crossing the river with dirty, wet clothing and the things we'd gone through, I was just as unkempt as the rest, unwashed, unshaved. We were walking along this road, and we came across some French transport that was carried by the horses, or drawn by the horses, I should say. All their carts had been tipped on the side, and their contents distributed and flung away as if trying to do some sort of sabotage so the Germans wouldn't have any access to anything that was left. And all the poor horses that were in the shafts were just shot where they were, dead. And there they were, the blood still coming from some of the heads where they'd been shot. And the smell of death and the smell of the dead horses was really terrific. Well, this was, it must have been a great long column of the French transport horses. You've seen a Frenchman walking around here and there. I don't know what they were doing, but we were passing on. And on the left-hand side of the road, there were some houses. We were in like a bit of a re-entrant where the hills come in from the top and down the sides to us. And we were walking down this low re-entrant to following the road to goodness knows where. Now, to be Dunkirk. There's some Royal Artillery officers had drawn their big heavy transport lorries that they were a beautiful thing with all sorts of special gears in of them days. They'd drawn them off the side of the road and they were smashing them up and setting them on fire. Well, two or three were burning fiercely because they'd let the petrol go and they went, and the rubber tyres were burning and the vehicles were burning. Well, it was a clear, warm day, as I mentioned, no wind, and the smoke was lying on the ground in the re-entrant where we went. And there was about four of these lorries being burnt, which I admired the officers for doing. Much more should have been done of that. We walked farther on, and the conglomeration of the French transport column was now something to be seen, to be believed. All these beautiful big horses lying dead in the harness, harness on, the carts on, and this was our first sign, apart from the lorries we just passed, of willful destruction to army vehicles to prevent them falling into German hands. And then as we moved further on, we could hear the German fighters and their bombers circling around up high and dropping bombs here and there. They had left us alone, but they were very close to us. And as we moved further down this column, it wasn't very far, by the way, you could see where the head of this column had been hit by aircraft. All the dead horses, all the dead men, black men, white men, all French. The French survivors had dragged out the black people and laid them on the side of by the hedge, and there they were, black and French soldiers, and some of the horses were struggling to get up, still dead, and people were going around shooting them to stop them, put them out of their agony. Now, you had this smell of blood, which was very prevalent. You could see these dead men, all the devastation and dereliction of a destruction caused by troops being told to destroy these things. The low smoke that was coming from the lorries and the aircraft flying overhead, it was just like passing through what we would term a scene from Dante's Inferno. I've said this before, people laugh, but it's just what it was like. Death and carnage on one side, dead people up on the hill and on the other side of the road, the lorries burning, casting smoke, the lorries exploding with some of their ammunition, and it was a thing that causes a spurt, and not only us, but everyone in front. So everyone in front was hurrying, so we hurried too to get out of this horrible place where we were, and this was just prior to Poperinge. We landed in the village of Poperinge. Now we could hear some semblance of order being given. Excuse me, I'm going to... This road was leading into Poperinge, and the first place we ever heard anyone giving orders. We heard people shouting in the distance, and we also heard the machine gunners coming down the road of the German aircraft, shooting up different people, shooting up things, which we couldn't see. We'd see them coming down, and their dive bombers also were active. And as we came into Poperinge, I was amazed to see two huge, like navy guns, beautiful polished steel. They were just like the ones that you have outside your museum, incidentally, in London, the Imperial War Museum. Maybe not quite so large, but they were on special type of army lorries, but they'd been laid on the road, and they were to act as a barrage against, an anti-tank obstacle for tanks coming down the road. And further on, a major was shouting, keep going, carry on. Keep going, we're getting this echo all along, different people telling, keep going, keep straight on as quick as you can. We're expecting the Germans to hit here any time now. Get moving. And I thought at this stage that we as regular soldiers, or infantrymen, would have been called in to help out with any sort of defence. And I was surprised that we weren't called, because I was sure with all this organisation going on that this was the place where they were going to make a stand and make a fight of it with the British Army. But lo and behold, we passed through into more jungle of army lorries by the thousands as we marched past them along this road, now on the road to Dunkirk. Poperinge had been bombed. There was a bit of, not a state of panic, but you could see it had been hit by dive bombers and machine guns. As I said, this big group of French cavalry, or whatever they were, their transport, all smashed up and broken. So the effects of the dive bombing apparently were aimed at the troops escaping down this road, which was one of the main roads from our front through Poperinge to Dunkirk.